Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Lorkin it.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
And Chaman Wu.
How's it going?
So I believe this is the same core four we had last week. So Mikhail and James are unavailable. We'll see them again, hopefully next week or soon. We'll still talk a little bit about some of the features they've put up on the site, but they won't be joining us on the cast. We're recording this in the second to last weekend of August. We're recording this during the network test for Duskbloods. So we'll talk about that. But we'll also talk about, as the first game for this week, we're going to be talking about Brigandine Abyss. This is a strategy RPG that is releasing later in the month, but the review embargo's up, and Chow is actually going to be taking point. He wrote up a review for us on that. So we're going to be talking about Brigandine Abyss first, then we're going to be talking about Duskbloods, the network test for that game, for that Switch 2 exclusive from Software. And then we'll go into the usual itinerary. We have some features up on the site. We have some performance features put up from Mikhail. We have a few previews put up by we have an interview with the Neo 3 devs from Adam. We have another interview from Mikhail with the Final Fantasy 14 and 16 team. And then we'll go into news about, you know, Trails in the Sky first and second chapter, a few trailers, and the usual fare from that point forward. So I think that's the general rundown. So a pretty kind of standard week for that. And yeah, without further ado, I'm just going to start out with our game number one here with Brigandine Abyss and handing it off to Chow, who wrote up the review for us for this game. So Chow, the embargo release for Brigandine Abyss, the game comes out in about 5 days or so from the time of recording at the end of the week. And just give us your thoughts on this game. I forget if you've played previous games in the series or not, but I know you've played plenty of strategy, you know, RPGs from all sorts of places. And go ahead and just take it away.
Okay, so this is the fourth game, actually, of Brigandine. Technically, it was PlayStation 1 when it got the original. And then they kind of like revised the game and made it better. And it's called Grand Edition, like Brigandine Grand Edition. But that was never released overseas, right? Most people say that's like probably the best game in the series, but I never played it. There is a fan patch out there if anyone wants to get a hand of that. But that's, people would say it's the best version. And then eventually, like, you know, decades later, you know, there's a sequel and that comes in, was it, Brigandine?
Runeterra?
Yeah, that one. I reviewed that one previously, which is, I think came out during near COVID or something.
Yeah, it was around 2020. Well, I think it had a staggered release because I think it was like PlayStation only, then Switch, then PC, or something like that. So it kind of came out a couple different times. I played it actually just earlier this year.
Yeah, I reviewed it on Switch, and, you know, I like the game, you know. I think it's more like something like Risk. I'm not sure I'm going to play that board game Risk. I usually, like, hang out with my cousins on Sundays to usually play board games back then. And Risk is one of the board games that we sort of, like, swap around and play. But it's a lot like that. It's like the more territory you have, the more resources you get, and, you know, if you want to conquer somebody else's land, you basically need to, like, divide up your forces, and it kind of plays similar like that, right? And you don't have enough forces.
It's very similar to Risk. Runeterra is. I actually remember when I was playing it earlier this year, there was, like, one faction that was, like, I had almost defeated, and my main force was trying to, like, take out their last faction, but their last cluster of armies kept, like, retreating and backing up and, like, claiming locations that didn't have many people on them, so they kept kind of just, like, moving around the map as just, like, one cluster of, like, an army that was, like, the only thing they had. And, like, this reminds me of a Risk game, you know, just they don't really own any territory, they're just kind of moving around taking out, like, these bases that have, like, one guard so they can survive, and they're just, like, avoiding, they're just, like, delaying the inevitable. Anyways, my point is that, yes, the territory conquering part of that game is very much like Risk. Does Brigandine Abyss have a similar sort of map fortress?
Yeah, it's basically exactly the same, but I think what makes it different is how you start out in this game. Like, in that game, it's like, okay, you have all these factions that you could pick, right? And, you know, that's kind of like the difficulty because of where they start out, right? It's like, hey, this person has no resources, but there is only one territory next to him. So technically, they wouldn't be, like, you know, attack from different sides, right? So it's like, so, you know, that's kind of like their advantage, right? And they're also in, like, the forest or something like that. And because they're in the forest, they're really easy to defend, you know, stuff like that. So you could say it might be an advantage to have that kind of location. And then if you pick that one nation that had, I think it was like three different territories, it's like, okay, they have the most resources, they have that, but they're basically being attacked from all different sides. So it's like, if you can manage that, I think that's the faction to choose, right? So this game's kind of similar, but you don't get to pick where your starting point is. Or their starting point is, like, they only have one faction attacking them. Everyone starts with nothing in this game, so you don't really start off with like that, right? And then there's also, like, they made, like, story reasons that you can't attack certain nations for some reason. Like, for me, I picked this faction called the Scarlet Will. Because, you know, you get to play as this girl that looks like a Pegasus Knight, basically, in Fire Emblem, sort of. And I would even call her path the Fire Emblem Slop. It's like, this story basically starts off exactly like Path of Radiance, basically. You basically get, a mercenary dad that gets killed, and you got a princess that, you know, ends up going with the kingdom, trying to reclaim her kingdom, and you, as a mercenary leader, is trying to help them reclaim that kingdom. Does that sound like Path of Radiance?
It does. I mean, if you're gonna copy your homework, copy from Path of Radiance, I guess.
And then it's like, there's even a thief that has green hair that acts as a guardian. I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, like I said, it's like, it feels like,
so
I'm playing
in Runerzia. You pick from, like, one of six factions. It's the same in Abyss. You pick from, like, when you go to start new game, you pick one of a few options.
Yeah, you start with six different factions that you can pick from. The story basically starts with this one guy who steals the Brigadine armor, and he kills the king in front of everybody, and then the game starts from there. And it's like, in my route that I pick, I pick Scarlet Will, so you would see Garnet, who's the main character of that will. Her dad tries to fight this bad guy that stole the Brigadine armor. His name is Chaosless. I can't take him seriously because he has a stupid name. And then when you finish the entire story, his reason for, like, starting this whole thing is even more stupider. I can't take the story seriously from all the bad guys in this. They are literally have, like, the stupidest motivations on why they're doing this.
Is it, like, cartoony, an example, or
it's like, okay, let's say one person is like, one of the main bad guys that you fight is, like, one of the generals that also work with this Chaosless guy. His name is, like, Heinberg or something. I forgot his exact name because they're so unmemorable. But he basically, like, started this entire war because it's like, I'm here to help out a friend. So you're going to abandon your daughter and commit war crimes? Are you serious? But it's like, and then it's like this bad guy, it's just like, he's just talking about everyone needs to be strong. And you basically prove to him that the power of friendship can conquer any power or some shit. But I can't take him seriously. It's just like, the storyline, I don't think it's good. I don't think you would play this game for the storyline, really. There are, like, character interactions and stuff, which is okay, but if you're talking about, like, the main story and what the villain does in this game, it's like, don't play for that. But I also tried with different faction, too. I tried out their starting story, and I think they might have a different last boss. I can't confirm, because I haven't beaten their route. I only beat in Scarlet Will. You know, I think a lot of reviewers only beat, like, one faction. Like, I don't think they would beat all six factions to see how the story differs, right?
How long does a faction storyline take?
So, basically, in Scarlet Will, you have 30 seasons. Each season is a turn. So how this game is also different is that after, like, you know, like, 10 seasons or something like that, there's a story event. In a story event, there is this battle that you have to participate. It happens somewhere in the map, and you would participate to fight that group of people. And you could use any forces, like, regardless of where they're located in the map, but if you fight in this battle, if you can't win, then you're basically like softlocked in the game. So you're forced to beat these battles, right? And so after like you beat all of them, then the game ends, basically, right? So basically, that's different, right?
So between the forest battles, you're encouraged just to explore and do like non-forest battles to power up your units. Is that kind of how it works?
You'll be conquering land, right? It'll be just playing like a Prius Brigadine game. You'll be just like, oh, conquer this place, and now I have more resources. Story-wise, it doesn't really make sense, because in Scarlet Will, it's like, I am trying to, like, get everyone united to fight Colossus, or Chaosless, and then it's like, but why am I killing my friends to gather an army to fight him? It doesn't make sense, right? It's like, I don't know. And then it's like, there's one faction that completely hates Garnet. They're called a Bonnie Fang or whatever. It's like this mercenary is like, it's like, you stole our jobs, so I'm going to kill you guys. And later on you find out, it's like, hey, wait a minute. It's like, don't we have the same goals? We both hate Chaosless. Shouldn't we be working there? No, I hate you, Garnet.
It's like, is that like another faction you could have picked at the start?
No, they don't let you pick that faction for some reason.
Okay.
But they're part of the story as like this hostile nation towards Garnet. And for some reason, the story blocks you from fighting them, because it forces you to fight them in story battles, I guess. So you can't conquer them, even though you're like sworn enemies. You know, it kind of doesn't make sense in a gameplay's point of view. And then meanwhile, I'm conquering my friendly nations. It's like, to get more territory, but I can't fight Ibn a Fang, even though we're supposed to hate each other. So some gameplay logic just doesn't make sense in this game, right?
So there's like some dissonance between... You go ahead, Adam, and then I'll go after you.
I was going to ask something slightly different in terms of the actual direct like tactical gameplay combat. In Legend of Runeterra, you'd have like your rune knights, which are sort of like your squad commanders, and then they would have like each would have 3 to 5 monster enemy or monster like units that you would control. And so you would have like these sort of like mini squads that you would attack with. And it was situated in such a way where like each rune knight had to be the monsters had to stay close to the rune knight, so you kind of had like these little like, you know, formations or whatever, and most of your actual like muscle were monsters, even though the rune knights were very strong. Is it kind of a similar formatting here?
You basically get the same format. So you got your leader unit, and they have 5 monsters that go with them, and depending on how much commanding power they have, it's how many like monsters they can bring out. Like certain monsters like cost more and certain cost less. Personally, what makes it different here is that they don't need to stay close to the leaders to get, like, buffs. But if they fight close to each other, there's, like, this chain debuff towards enemies. Like, you'll see, like, this chain. And it'll lower their, like, invasion rate. So it's, like, you can start to attack, like, certain like, if someone, like, has very high dodge and poor... And your monsters have poor accuracy... And then you gang up on them and you see the chain on them. It's like, then they can barely dodge and they can't barely move. So that's kind of like one of the advantages of having a unit surrounding somebody. But in the end, it's like, I think the biggest change in this game is they added this thing called a rally system. So the leader unit can kind of like take a unit within themselves, and then they'll have their traits. And then you could also dismiss that monster and put it back in the field. But the traits could be, like, overpowered. Like, for example, I think the last boss in this game is completely overtuned to shit. I don't know what the hell they were thinking of this last boss. Like, they had, like, over, like, 7,000 HP for some reason. And then it's like, you know, like, the whole game, it's like, by the end of the game, you only have, like, 800. It's like, so... And then he also has, like, this AoE attack that hits everybody and kills, like... was it, like, 300 damage to everybody that's within 5... like tiles within him, so and he could spam it like every 5 turns or something like that. So it's like what the hell were they thinking with this guy? And one of the ways I killed him was I basically absorb a monster that gives it knockback, and then an archer with like, you know, it's like kind of like a, what is it, like in Fire Emblem where you use a horse unit and they could move again sort of after, you know, after hitting someone. Mm-hmm. I forgot what that feature is called, but
Anto, I believe.
But basically, if you absorb a wolf unit, you could give a unit that kind of feature where they start to like able to move again. So what I did was I have them keep attacking this guy and he would knock him back so he can't counterattack. And then the archer would just kite him for like, and I ran around in circles for like 30 turns doing this strat to kill last boss. So it's like,
difficulty settings? Like, did you play on normal or what?
There's easy, normal, and hard. I try hard and it's like, it's not fun to play because your accuracy is so low and hard. So there's like this hidden modifier where the enemy units seems to have like this extra dodge rate and their defense are a little higher. So it's just more annoying than anything. It's like, okay, so it's like, oh, it's like your unit usually has 60% of hitting them. Now you have 40%, so you're kind of like missed most of the time. You know, it's like, and then it's like, you know, every turn is kind of crucial in a strategy game. So it's just like, I don't think it makes it like more challenging. And then if you're like using magic units, it's like, okay, well, they're going to have 100% hit rate. The thing is that there are skills that you could only use while you're standing still. So magic units are like very vulnerable. So, but you could kind of mitigate this problem by using, what is it? If you get this monster, this lizard man type of race, I forgot what they're called exactly, but you get them and you get this trait where you let them have double turn. So you basically use like a wizard with that trait. They'll move someone and then they end their turn, then they have the turn again, they could cast their magic and then it's like boom, they hit them, and it's like a very abusive strategy that you could use. It's like there's lots of like things that you could abuse. But I
understand that like hard modes to some extent have to be like stat sliders, but doing it on the hit chance rather than just like on some other value like defense or attack power just seems kind of like, oh, if you're lucky it'll feel the same as normal, but you could also just get very unlucky, and if you just miss a lot then it's going to feel terrible because it's just up to chance.
So
the way you described it, that's my kind of initial thought.
That's what I think too. So it's like, I don't think there's any reason to play on like hard. I think normal's good enough. I don't think the AI is very smart. They're really easy to abuse on what they do. In this game, the AI never seems to attack your army if you put like plenty of leaders there, even though they're not stacked with like the right army. So it's like, but they will always attack like a nation that has like, oh no, maybe like one or two leaders or something like that. Just because it's like, oh, it's like I guess the AI probably thinks that they're not strong, even though you could put a bunch of level ones in that one zone and just like plenty of them. And then it's like during combat, it's like, you know, they would never move unless you get within their attack range. So you could exploit this behavior by like, oh, maybe I'll just have one monster to lure to their attack range and have them start moving. And then it's like, okay, well, and then I already have my units already placed nicely to lay all these like magic traps on them. So it's like the AI is like very easy to exploit, so I don't think there's much strat to them. Like, the map's also small, so you can't really like think of like crazy like big epic battles like I don't know, maybe like Fire Emblem Conquest. There's like that one battle in the port. You're defending for your freaking life in that port, you know? Like, so I don't know. It's just I think that's kind of like my issue with Burgundy, and it's just like the game is really poorly balanced, I would say.
So you started out basically saying that the story was hard to take seriously, primarily because for you kind of outlined two reasons. You said the antagonists basically were not good, not believable. You couldn't take them seriously. And then you even said just like the story and the gameplay, the way they interacted, just didn't seem to mesh because you would have like certain limitations placed on you based on who you could and couldn't attack or certain allies that you'd have to not ally with. Like, you mentioned these force battles that like progress the story between like your optional time between those battles. How many of those force battles are there? Because you mentioned you beat this game, I think you mentioned it, in like 10 or 15 hours.
Yeah.
Which is pretty short for a strategy RPG, I think.
Like, people could spend more hours. I think it's like, this game can be very time consuming as you get further, because it like, by the near the end of the game, the organization things where you like organize a magic unit, that could take forever once you have like conquered like so many land. It's like, oh, do I want to put this guy? I need to level up this unit, blah 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 blah. You know, that could be very time consuming, right? But you know, it's like I basically find that the best strat is just to rely on the good units. And then I basically put all like the crap units into lands that you had to conquer like four different lands to get through. So they were busy farming more stuff. There's this feature called quests. You basically send your units to expedition trip to gather materials or find rare items. Like sometimes you can find like really rare armor or equipment. And then it's like, and then once you found it once, it's like there would be sold in shops. So now everyone could get this armor, you know? So that's like the reason why you would have, you know, units sent on expedition trips, right? And so eventually it's like, you know, this game's only time consuming based on how much you micromanage, I would say. But I wasn't like super micromanaged. I did like, I always kept like my main units like very strong. So it's just like, oh, they could just blitz through everything. Because like one of the things is like Garnet in her route, it's like she basically has so much defense. So what I did is just, you know, just have her go to the front, buff her defense like crazy, and all the mobsters start to do no damage. And the only thing she needs to worry about is people bringing in magic units, which is kind of rare because like AI doesn't seem to have lots of like magic units. I think my army in the end is like bringing these two fiends. Fiends are like, you know, they could use very powerful AoE magic that hits a huge zone, but you know, they have to like stationary, so it's really hard to like get them all within like one place. So, but yeah, it's kind of hard to like ramble about like how everything works in this game.
Like, no, I was actually kind of thinking like you've described a good bit about like how the story is, about how like the moment to moment gameplay. You talked a little bit about mechanics that you felt like you could exploit, or like certain ways that you felt like you were encouraged to do one tactic over another. This is a little bit of a blunt question, but like, okay, what? I don't know, like a more straightforward way to ask this. Like, what do you think the game did well? Or was there like a certain nugget of the game that you actually came away from thinking like that was interesting, or I actually kind of like how that was, because that seems to be lacking at this point, is something that you feel positively about?
I think there is good things about this game. I think the gameplay loop could be addicting. I mean, it's like playing Risk. Once you start to get the thrill of conquering all these lands and start to have, you know, you start having like this power trip, it's like, I want all the territory. I think that's like... I think that's like the fun part of playing these games. And I think that's like one of the redeeming qualities, like how much stuff there is. There's lots of replayability. There's six different factions on a story mode. So if you try to go through all of them, you'd probably be spending 100 hours, right? And then...
Do the factions have any difference from like a gameplay's perspective in terms of like units or strategies you can use? Or is it primarily story? If you pick a different faction,
I would say it's story and your starting unit. So I tried like them.
Okay.
Was it? There's this one faction where you play as this kid called who's a Chimera unit. They call him Tite F. And the story basically, like, okay, it starts out the same thing with that Chaosless killing the Emperor. But when you start out his story, as you don't get to see the scene with him like announcing him conquering the world or whatever. You start with this mad scientist sending out these two units. One's called Tite S and one's called Tite F. And they're called Chimera units. And they're basically sent them to kill the Saint. And when Chimera Type F tried to fight the Saint, he couldn't kill her because she's like, you know, I guess his human emotion comes in. And then it's like the scientist seems to be useless. So he sends Tite S, his sister, to kill him. And then he's left for dead. And then eventually the Saint comes find him, and then she restores him back to life and tries to, like, you know, save everybody. And then the church is, like, not happy that, you know, that the Saint has saved this poor kid, and this guy's, like, scheming, planning something evil in the background. So I feel like this story might have a different last boss. I don't know. But it's, like, it already starts off different, right? So. And then there's a different faction where this guy is trying to find his lost dragon. You know, it's like, so, like, I feel like they have different last bosses, but we all get the same intro of Chaosless, but I can't guarantee that, you know, they all just end up going fighting Chaosless, because I don't know why everyone starts off the same way when their story feels like they're nothing related to each other, right?
It'd be interesting to see after the game comes out, or to compare across reviews, like, how much they diverge. Or if it's just kind of like six versions of the same events.
And then there's like, there's even like more factions like there, because there's the, for Brigadine like series fans, I hear that like there's always been like a story mode, but that seems to be more of a mode that's like kind of secondary to the mission mode, which is what compels most of the series veterans to it, because that has like the most flexibility in terms of like how you want to make custom games. And the story mode, like by playing through it, like unlocks like units and stuff for that mission mode. So I hear is that
this game wants you to use all the units in faction mode. There's it's called mission mode in this. So there's 24 factions in this game, actually.
Yeah,
that's a lot. Well, actually, maybe 25 if you count the main bad guys faction too. But you know, 24 factions in mission mode, and they all have different objectives to beat the game if you choose that mode. So they're like kind of custom rules, right? It'll be okay. So there's this one woman. If you pick her faction, she owns some kind of crazy debt, and every season she needs to pay off this debt. And if you don't pay it off, it's game over. And there's also like story events. So it's like, so you have some gameplay conditions. And then if you choose like the Holy Church faction, it's basically they need to conquer the world, but they need to only use magic class units. So you can't use like, you know, like certain units. So you're kind of locked to certain conditions. And some like are super easy, like this this fairy nation. All she does is that she needs to upgrade her base to level 3, and that's it. It's like, okay. It could be short, it could be like long. It all depends on what you choose, right?
Okay, so. Yeah. I think that's a kind of the big charm of it, because like it's like almost Civilization in a way, where you have different ways to like win in Civilization. Try to up your tech to like the space age, or you're going to, or you try to win it through diplomacy. Stuff like that. So like it's cool to hear that like, hey, different factions have like very like thematic way that like fits their specific factions victory conditions, something that's like it resonates with them. It's not always the same condition of like rule everyone, or you know, you win the same way. It's like, no, you have to see, you have different problems to worry about per faction, which is cool.
But I also think it's like StarCraft custom games, you know? Yeah. It's like back in the day, it's like everyone makes up all kinds of weird scenarios.
I forgot, does this have like online multiplayer or stuff like that that you can play with others and kind of almost like in Civ?
I don't think there is.
Okay.
I
don't know too much about the series.
Like, I
know.
Yeah, because I went straight for story mode, so.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like for my approach with the game.
Okay.
Like, I don't think it's bad. It's like it's just unpolished. I also feel bad about bashing the story, because I think there's like one interviewer talking to like the story creators, and they're like talking so positively about the story and stuff. Man. I'm like, I feel kind of bad bashing about it.
You can only folks. Recount the opinion that you had like on it, right? So,
but it's like. Yeah, I definitely think the story is one of the weakest part, but you don't play a Brigadine game for its story. Like, you know, the last game, it's like, I think there wasn't much of it. That's kind of like its issue. And they kind of try to remedy that by adding more events, but it's just like, it's not good.
And there's also like, there's also like the divisive issue of like the art style change as well, because Renergia had a very striking, you know.
It looked like Valkyrie Profile. That's what it looked like to me. Like the character designs and that.
Yeah.
Well, and the UI is also much better. It's like in this one, it felt like a mobile game with the UI. It's like with all these gradient circles and like the big font, you know, and stuff.
What did you play on?
I played on PC, and I think one of the worst thing about this game is the performance. You basically play on Unreal Engine 5, and the game recommended me play in max settings, but I lowered the setting to like low, and I already feel like my computer is like struggling. For like a long session of this game, it'll be like it'll be like heating up. That's, like
it's crazy. A heavy game, interesting.
And you're like, but the graphics don't look that good. It's like, why is it taking so much resources? Yeah. So it's like,
did you play with a keyboard or controller?
A bit of both, because once a thing starts throttling, it's like, okay, well, I can't use wireless in this anymore. It's just not.
I think function. That would be a U-specific problem.
It's like
wireless, like. Ends up coming out, cutting out it once it heats up or whatever.
Yeah, then I switch to keyboard and there will be no input delay. It's just like stuff like that. But that sounds like a me problem. Yeah, true. But yeah, I'm just saying, like, this game just throttles like crazy after just like, you know, like an hour or two of playing this game.
I am interested to see like if more people run into that probable release.
It's like I can't say like it's like it's a my issue, but that's what I experience. Like I play other games no problem. Like I play Arknights Enfield and my computer wouldn't throttle after long sessions, and you know, or maybe like the Trails in the Sky, you know, second chapter that just came out.
Unreal Engine 5 is like one of those like engines. It's like it's a very case by case basis, and depending on how experienced the developers might be with its tool set and the way they modified it to you know develop their game. There's definitely some pitfalls I hear that you know more inexperienced developers with that engine can run into that will cause that has performance ramifications. You know, like do you need all this nanite tech in it? To get your game as pretty as it is, or can you, you know, work without that and prioritize performance instead? Because nanite is like heavy on and taxing machines, you know, stuff like that behind the scenes. Just little decisions that add up.
Like one of the things I don't really like how it is. It's just like the texture, like the grass. You can see like the Unreal Engine grass, but like the 3D models don't look that good. It's like I don't know, the graphic style doesn't seem to mesh. They don't need to use such a crazy engine for this kind of game. At least, I think they should have just used something, like, much smaller in scope. At least that's what I feel.
Yeah, it's hard. Because it's definitely, like, Unreal Engine 5 can, you know, run well on systems if you're experienced enough with the tool set to get it there. Like, Silent Hill, for example. Silent Hill F, like, that's a game that was on Unreal Engine 5 and worked pretty well on launch for most machines because they were able to work around what worked and what didn't. There's a like balancing visual fidelity and quality with how much it's taxing the system.
This seems like a good spot to shout out that Mikhail did do a pretty thorough performance comparison for Brigadine across PS5, PS5 Pro, Switch 2, Xbox, and a few PC handhelds. And gleaning through it here, you can read up the full details up on rpgsite.net. He focused a lot on load time, like dashboard to title or loading a save, as well as just like frame rate. It seems like that only the PC can deliver frame rate above like 60 or above. All other consoles are less than that. The Switch 2 version just doesn't look that great, but it does. It's probably the best portable version. The Xbox does allow for quick resume if the load times get annoying, so you can kind of use that as a crutch. But yeah, it just sounds like it's like a 30 to 40 FPS experience kind of across consoles. So it's seems just like a heavy game in general, which
that for sucks strategy, too, because like it when you look at it visually, like does it justify that performance? It's like probably not.
I believe the PC version didn't even have 60 FPS on launch.
Yeah. The like Switch demo. 2 version appears to use some settings below the PC's lowest preset. So maybe Switch 2 is not that great. So there you go.
I believe they added a 60 FPS patch to the PC version.
Target targets 30 FPS, not locked. So yeah, just frame rate issues kind of abound across platforms. Definitely give Mikhail's article a read for very specific targets between PS5, PS5 Pro, Switch 2, all of those. Because it just seems like it's kind of a struggle in most places. Did you have any other final thoughts on Brigadine Abyss? Or any like final like capstone?
Like I was kind of debating with the score. Like I think I was just being soured by just like the story and the performance. I think, but there is a good game in here. You know, like this could be a very addicting game, like loop. You know, if you get into it. So at least, like, I don't want people to just look at the score and think, "Oh, this game must be dog shit." Like, you know, there's redeeming qualities in this game. You know,
as always, people should read the reviews instead of scrolling down to a score and then moving and then immediately Xing out. Who'd have thought?
Yep, so go ahead and give, if you want to, you know, get his written thoughts, you can read Chow's thoughts on Brigadine Abyss up on rpgsite.net. Sorry, I don't know why I stammered to get that out. And then, of course, the companion piece from Mikhail about all the performance across consoles and PC handhelds. For the second game we're going to be talking about, I mentioned it at the top of the broadcast. We are recording this, at least to my knowledge. There's been updates that I'm sure Josh knows better than I do, that we are recording this during the network test for Dusk Bloods, the Switch 2 exclusive PvE, I hope I got the right letters, from Software Game. And they had the network test, but I heard some news about them shutting it off. They're going to schedule additional days. Josh, you're the one that's most got the direct up-to-date information about this network test. You've been playing it. And I know you're a little bit limited on potentially on what you can say or what you can show or talk about, but
I can talk about it, but technically you can't show screenshots or live stream it or like share any or take video of the network test itself.
Okay.
So, but you can talk about it. And of course, I'm sure people all over the internet have already seen footage, whether it's through official means from other outlets or, you know, people not following the restrictions, because it's a closed network test, but it's pretty much they allowed everyone who applied to like go through, so there's a sizable base. You know, of course, people are gonna.
To tee you off, I've not been following this game very closely because I'm not really interested just in the style of game. But I will just say, just through osmosis, the one thing that I've seen kind of through my socials over the last couple of days is Zork.
Zork. Everyone loves Zork. Well, everyone loves the design of Zork and what Zork represents. But when playing, there's actually a true, for people who want to win easily, there's actually another character that's the one true answer, it seems like, now. But we'll talk about it. So the Dusk Bloods, as you said, it is a Switch 2 exclusive developed by From Software. This is the title that Miyazaki has been working on directly. And as you mentioned, it's a PvPvE. And the network test is not something that is 24/7. It's through different time slots. So it's from August 21st to 23rd. And it's the two time slots in for each day are 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. Pacific. And the first time slot, which was August 21st, 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. Pacific, I was asleep. I was having the time of my life, having sweet dreams. I don't know exactly what happened there, but I guess it was not working at that time slot. So they had to either cut it off early or just didn't hold it at all. They just canceled like the first session. And then it seems like the other time slots, their times and days were unaffected. It's just like that first one just didn't go through. Which is, you know, this is the purpose of a network test. Hey, we're going to see if like our network infrastructure is up to the task. And for the first session, clearly it was not. But for the second one, which I played at the time of this podcast recording, I played it last night at the August 21st, 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. slot. I played about 3.5 hours and got to play a full match with all six of the playable characters in the network test. So before I even talk about the characters, it's worth mentioning what this game plays like, just a general overview of what it is. It's different from Elden Ring Nightreign, because Elden Ring Nightreign was more of a PvE experience, and it is a more like you're powering your character up, you're leveling them up through stat increases, and also kind of getting like almost a build for your character. And after like a certain amount of time, there's like a fog that encloses in until you get to like a boss arena. You and your Elden Ring Nightreign comrades like kind of converge onto a slot, beat that boss, go into the next like part of it, like the next night or day, I forgot. And then same cadence until like there's a big boss at the end of it. That's the general flow of it. In the Dusk Bloods, it's very different from that in the sense that like. The first thing you'll notice is that this game is divided up into three phases, and I believe I already forgot the player count, but I think it's like up to 8 players participate in a match. And when you first like start phase one, there are the map that they give you in the network test is very, you know, Bloodborne-esque Victorian. setting with some outdoors areas, but there's like a clock tower at the south part, there's like a cathedral at the western part, some woods at the eastern part, and then like some town area like the northern part of it. And you can pick one of the four quadrants that you want to, or areas that you want to spawn in, but you cannot pick the exact area. It's only like you'll spawn somewhere in this area, but the specific spot you'll know when you spawn in. So you're not like picking a spot to spawn in. So when you spawn, the early goings is almost the same as a night rain, the same that like you probably want to go farm up mobs to level up to get yourself stronger, because your character, your playable character, has starts at level one always, and as you defeat enemies, you'll gain experience. There are some times when you pick up items, it might be just experience that you pick up as well. And there are sometimes like yellow circles, yellow floaty circles, like sigils that you'll see that you can summon like an AI partner with you for that match. They don't, when you summon them at these yellow sigils that you stumble upon, they don't join you right away. There seems to be like some time frame between like when you summon them and when they actually participate with you. But I'm not exactly sure the rules on that, because sometimes like when you fast travel to another spot, they'll spawn in with you. Sometimes when you die, you don't exit the match. You respawn as well. Sometimes they'll spawn in with you.
In that regard. Is that intended behavior, or is that just kind of like a weird quirk you observed?
It's an intended behavior for sure, but I'm not exactly sure why, what are the exact rules around it, but it's definitely deliberate that like they don't immediately spawn in with you when you like summon them for sigils. And you can only have one of these like partners at a time. The thing that you'll notice right away here is that this is a lot more mobile than any other From Software Souls games and even Sekiro, because when you dash, you move pretty fast. You can jump up to three times in the air, so you have a triple jump, and you can dash in midair as well. So you have a lot of mobility in that regard. You can actually queue up like a high jump by holding down the jump button to get like a big jump at first. So there's a lot of like vertical traversal as well in this game. And it never felt like, oh, it's going to be hard to reach that stuff with like my limited options. It's like, no, if you're confident that you can like reach to a higher place, you probably can, because of these traversal options. Also, everyone has a ranged option as well. With it, like the starting tutorial character when you first boot up the game is Albert, and he has like a fucking Tommy gun, as his ranged option. And all the other characters have like ranged options as well that have like either bullets or like a spell bar. That you reload. It's like infinite bullets and infinite other spell bar as well. Once you reload or let it charge, you can continue firing or casting spells. There's not like any like mana flask or ammo pack that you have to find to reload. And the purpose of really the three phases, but we'll start with phase one here, is that as you're you want to level up and kind of beef up your character, because you know leveling up raises their attack power, raises up their health max, but also along the way, throughout these three phases, you're trying to get this resource called virtue. And virtue is a fluctuating value in the sense that like you can earn it and you can lose it, and this value is basically your score for the match. And you're trying to raise it as high as possible to be within the top three at the end of phase three, because at the end of phase three, only the top three people with the highest virtue value face off in a 1v1v1 in this Grail battle, the next test, and all the others are cold. So everyone will get past phase one, but in phase two, at the end of phase two, like the top two, the bottom two people with the lowest virtue value are cold, and that's when you actually like leave the match, like you lost. And then end of phase three, everyone but the top three get cold, and you lost, move on type of deal. So how you gain virtue is through different ways. Sometimes they'll just be pickups, like drops from enemies that you defeat. Like you'll pick up, it's like, oh, I earned one virtue. Sometimes there'll be like something called a flame virtue, where there'll be like this corpse on a chair at the middle of nowhere, and you interact with it and you get a flame virtue, like when you activate it. When you participate in things called ritual battles, that is also a source of like how you gain virtue as well. When you participate in other events, like say a random person has activated like a boss battle in the world, like they actually have like a boss health bar on it, people in the surrounding vicinity have the option to assist them in that boss battle, and if they're successful, you all get a share of the virtue that that boss rewards. So there's different ways of earning virtue. It's not always just straightforward, I have to do this all the time. There are some like characters who have specific ways to gain virtue. Like one of the characters can designate a target for them that they can only see, and they want to target that person. And if they eliminate them, they'll get virtue that way as well. And this can have wild swings. But for example, at the end of phase three for one of my matches, I was Zork during this match. It was a ritual battle at the end of phase three, and what this ritual battle wanted us to do, because not all ritual battles are the same, is they wanted us to pick up this like gemstone and insert it into like this new cross device at this cathedral, and it takes like maybe like 5 to 8 seconds to like fully insert it there. So like, you are exposed in that time frame, which is a good while if people are nearby. But if you insert it, you'll gain a lot of virtue, but it's all like temporary until the that phase is done, because someone can actually get their own gemstone and overwrite your ceiling, and they can steal the virtue away from you. So nothing is a done deal until that phase is done and that ritual battle ends. So it's kind of like almost capture the flag and hold it in a sense that like you are trying to make sure that you are securing the zone just for you. I had a virtue value of 13 as Zork, and that was pretty low. And I'm not exactly sure what happened in this particular phase, but I was able to secure my gemstone, and there was a lot of people fighting over that spot, so no one had no time to like insert the gemstone after. And I bonked like 3 to 4 of them with my skill, which is like the E Honda for Street Fighter, like flying headbutt into them. Whatever happened, and my virtue value went from 13 to 67 in like 5 seconds, and I was able to participate in the grill battle, even though I felt like I was like on the culling block for that. So it's one of those.
I feel like I missed something. How did you go from like 13 to 60 something by headbutting people? Is that basically what you did?
Basically, like I have no idea how, like I wasn't paying attention exactly of like why I went from 13 to 67 in like the almost blink of an eye of that. So that's what I mean by like virtue is a fluctuating value in this game. Just because you earn it doesn't mean you keep it, essentially. And sometimes when like another way you earn virtue is also by like almost leaderboard updates throughout a phase, where like let's say you're first or second place in virtue values, there'll be like an update in the middle of a phase that's, oh, you're second place, we'll reward you with this virtue. And you also might get like the collector achievement, which means like you've been going around collecting items, and if you collect more items than the others, you'll also get an additional reward of virtue. Then like maybe after like 2 to 3 minutes, they'll have another update of like, okay, what's your standing? Oh, you're now in first place. We'll give you additional virtue. Or if in your first place and you go to second place in that next update, we'll take away virtue from you because you weren't able to hold your standing from it.
Obviously, it seems like people haven't quite put together like all of the systems at play in terming, you know, addition of virtue, deletion of virtue or transferring it from one player to the other. It sounds like there might also be some considerations based on like, oh, I'm behind, I only have so much time left, I might need to change my tact and do something a little bit more risky, which might, like shooting the moon, might give me a lot of virtue in a short period of time, but might not, but I don't really have any other option because the match is about to end.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's like match modifiers sometimes that can assist or hurt you in that regard. Like, for example, in phase three, one of the random, like, when a phase starts, you'll get like almost like a tarot card flipping, and that'll signal like an event that you can expect that's going to happen in this next phase. So one of them is like a zeppelin and everyone gets a transmitter. You can use this transmitter once, but it's basically an aerial bombardment call, and everyone has access to it once. So you call that transmitter, and the Zeppelin will come over to you and fucking rain down hell below it. And I'm not sure if it does friendly fire or not, but it's one of those things, like, it could, you know, work out to your advantage, or maybe not. But everyone has the same capability, but they can only call on it once. Another thing is, like, one of the tarot card flippers would be like, hey, this courtyard area or this cathedral down there, we think, you know, this is going to be a great source of virtue this upcoming run. So it's like, you know, that the ritual battle is going to occur down there, so a lot of people will try to like spot in that area and like turn it to a hot zone immediately. But if you're crafty enough, maybe you'll spot in like another zone but make your way over there slowly, and when the ritual battle starts, you know, maybe you can like have another approach to it that is less obvious to others. It's like sneak in there and maybe get it before like everyone else, while everyone else is too busy trying to, you know, initiate combat with one another in that respect. So there's different like interesting like social dynamics that can like pop up, and it's kind of up to you to decide how you want to approach things in that regard. And that makes it really interesting.
So, in terms of like timing is important, but not always the same level of importance, because it depends on what other players are doing. Like doing this objective late in the match might be a good idea most of the time, but if you notice players are doing something, you might need to change your approach and say, actually, I'm going to go for that early because I've observed this thing that they're playing more, I don't know, cautiously or aggressively. So I need to change my approach. It does sound like it's a pretty like dynamic, system at play in terms of learning the maps, learning the techniques, realizing what other players are trying to do, and adjusting your approach accordingly.
Because you have to be efficient with your time. Like sometimes you'll get into like the dumbest situations. Like let's say I spot another Zork, and we just have a 1v1 Zork match trying to flying headbutt each other. Mm-hmm. Is that really an efficient use of our time? Probably not. Is it funny though? Absolutely. So like it's one of those things. Like you can get into like really dumb encounters, which is like amusing in its own round. Sometimes it's not the most worth it, but sometimes like there's like, gonna be a persistent player that tries to like, you know, is hell bent on killing you. And you're just like, okay, how do I deal with it? And one of the things that like you have to consider as well is, unlike Night Rain, this has fast travel at any time as long as you're not in combat. There's like an icon at like your lower left that will signify to you whether fast travel is available. But as long as you're not as long as you're not in combat, you can fast travel to any other point in that like entire map that you're given. So there's like no limitations. As long as you have that, you know, fast travel capability, you're not in combat, you can go fast travel anywhere. So like there have been times where like I see a player that's like gunning for me, but I can still fast travel, so I just fast travel right away before they can even get to me, and I'm at another part of the map, they don't know where I am, and I'm off doing off my own stuff as well. So that like it's a very interesting dynamic, like, just because, you know, there are people here and like all populated and it's gonna be hard to get out. It's like, no, you can just like fast travel out at any time, or if you wanna, or if there's like a particular like item of interest or boss that like you wanna get to, you can get there relatively fast as well, on top of all the mobility you're given as well. So for the characters, there's a brief rundown of the characters. The tutorial character that you first play when you boot up the game is Albert. He's very straightforward. Has the Tommy gun. Has like a blade. has your, you know, standard light and heavy attacks for all of them, like in Souls games. His special ability has like these blood waves that you can shoot out, like projectiles. I forgot his secondary ability already, but the, like, everyone starts out with like a primary ability and then a secondary ability that will open up after you reach a certain level. And there's not always like, this is the ability that everyone gets at level 3. It's like, no, sometimes some people get like an ability at level 5, and some people don't get their secondary ability to like level 12. So it's very case-by-case scenario on that. But this guy, very straightforward, you know, default character of the game. One of the more unique characters, Bloodhead Yan. From the reveal trailer, he's that guy with like the all white linen clothing and like that almost iron helmet that like covers almost his entire face, covers his eyes, has a weird design, has an axe that's pretty damn good. But he is one of the more unique characters because he's the guy that can designate a target as like almost like he's like an executioner or inquisitor of some sorts. And by activating an emote, a specific emote, he can, it takes like maybe like 20 to 25 seconds to actually finish this emote, but then like it'll designate, hey, your target is over there. So you can like give yourself an additional objective that's only available to this character on that. His abilities for, God, I'm getting it mixed up with another one. I forgot. He has like the puddle, I believe, where you can like shoot out a spike, a blood spike. And another one was, man, I forgot the other one already for him.
I mean, it's a lot, yeah. But yeah. I like the idea of a character that's kind of like an assassin or executioner type that can like mark a person to get some sort of bonus or penalty on them.
Yeah.
The fact that they learn abilities at different rates is kind of neat from like a balancing and gameplay perspective, because like certain characters might unlock their abilities more quickly, but their ceiling isn't as high, versus other characters that might unlock them slowly. So they might struggle early in a match, but excel later in a match. And then learning how to balance that in an interesting way sounds just like a real cool place to play around mechanically.
Yeah. Another character is Treng La, and she's like really the assassin ghost type character, where she has like dual chakrams as her weapon, and her primary ability is invisibility. So that like this is the one like if you really want to sneak around and like say like during a ritual battle people are too focused on either like elite enemies or other players, like you with her in hand you might be able to like just sneak in, get the like cathedral device itself all through invisibility because people aren't like paying attention to you. Her secondary ability is like summoning like a snake out of the ground and does a lot of damage, which is pretty cool. She can also like throw her chakrams as well as her ranged option. She's a fun character, but a tricky character because I actually got her to the Grail battle, and like she doesn't do great damage. You have to I still don't know exactly like what's the best way to like deal with 1v1 encounters with her, because she's a very tricky character to get a lot of damage on to experience. Next one is Sniper Layla. Sniper Layla is pretty cool. This is like your gun character. That their primary melee is like Katars. They don't ever melee with this character if you can. They suck ass with melee. But they do have a sniper rifle, and that does a lot of damage on its own. You can zoom in with a sniper rifle if you want, if you're good at headshots. But this is, but even if you're just like doing the auto lock or the lock on with the sniper rifle, because it does good damage. Has like almost like a fast move ability where they like transform into like a swarm of insects and can like move a distance. But their secondary ability is pretty fucking rad, because the secondary ability summons a Gatling gun from their chest. Like it just bursts from their chest and you can go to town with this Gatling gun. And I guess I should mention that throughout the match, there are these like red insects. They sort of look like the glowing things that you would defeat for upgrades, like in other Souls games. But if you defeat like these red insect bugs, you can upgrade your characters. So some of these upgrades are like do more damage with melee, do more damage with skills, less cooldown in your skills, etc. Like, you know, with Sniper Layla, I was able to upgrade this Gatling gun all the way to like 100 bullets and does more damage and reloads pretty fast. They were a lot of fun with that. But the Gatling gun does take some time to get used to because you are animation locked when summoning it and you can't really move as well. So my tech I did with Layla was I would jump into the air and mid-jump while in the air, you can summon your Gatling gun. So when I'm on the ground again, I have my Gatling gun ready to go. So that was my tech with Layla. Very fun character, but it takes some time to get used to it. Like, at first I had a bad opinion of this character until I got further into the map. This has become the meta pick, this next character. This character's name is Senator Samir Patres. And Senator? This guy... What's that?
Was that Senator?
Senator Samir Patres. And this guy is he is a character that has a rapier as his primary attack. And he is a menace. He is a menace because his secondary ability allows you to turn into a T-Rex and lunge forward. And if you make contact with the enemy during that lunge, and that lunge is pretty damn far, he will like basically chomp them, continue biting them, and it takes out like an easy 50% of an enemy's health if they have a large enough health bar. But if you still have a small health bar, it's pretty much an instant kill. So, and you're fully invincible during this whole duration when he activates the T-Rex form as well. So, if you are committing too much to an attack against Senator Samir Patres, during mid-attack, he can just turn into a T-Rex and say, fuck you, and take out almost all of your health, if not outright kill you. And this has been a very popular pick to win with for people, as people have played more and more. You'll see a lot of this character in lobbies now, and a lot of them, usually at least one of them, in grill battles, because this T-Rex move is really good. Like, even if you know the theory behind like avoiding it, which is going airborne, if you committed to an attack or like an ability that's like a long animation, he'll just chomp. So you have to be really wary about fighting this character, because T-Rex form will just fuck you up. That's everyone loves Senator. Everyone. And then, of course, even though Senator is the meta pick, the one, the champion for all of our hearts in Dust Bloods is Zork. And Zork is a miracle upon the world. He has like this heavy armored deep diving suit, and uses like a pipe rod as his melee weapon that you can charge up to fill with electricity. He has like that human rocket, almost E Honda, flying headbutt move that does a lot of damage if it hits. And his secondary one puts like artillery cannons on his back, and you can fire like missiles from it, which is very cool. Very armored core inspired in a way. But and all of them have their pros and cons. Like Zork is like, you know, he's armored, and I don't know if he has more defense, but he's very animation locked to his moves, even like his basic moves, because he's a very heavy character. Like all his rolls are fat rolls. And that's something that's just like inherent to the character. While others are, you know, they have less animation committed moves, so they have that working for them, but they might have less health. Or in Layla's case, like they have a lower health pool, but that they inherently can recover health over time. So it's one of those, you know, balancing situations where this character, like, you don't have a lot of health, but they can constantly regen health as an offset. And you're not supposed to be in the midst of combat with Layla anyway. You're the sniper character. It's a very interesting game to play. I think it's also a frustrating game to play on a technical level, in the sense that like it's aiming for 60 FPS, but it rarely ever maintains 60 FPS because you're usually out on the field and it's fluctuating between like it feels like 35 to 45 FPS at any given time, along with your controls are not the most responsive. There's definitely noticeable input lag in terms of like how when your character reacts to like the button press. So there'll be times where like I'm like pressing a button like 5 times and then the game will finally pick up like, oh, you're trying to press this button. Interesting. That's an interesting input that you've got there. Didn't think of that about that. And there's also like situations where like, let's say like your universal like Estus Flask equivalent health recovery is on up D-pad. So thumbing to that quickly in heated situations can sometimes accidentally misinput you to like a directional another directional input in your D-pad, and one of them is like the use icon, which will animation lock you. So I've actually considered like, do I just bind up D-pad to like one of my back pedals on my Pro controller so I don't have to deal with this, because it's not ideal to like immediately try to go to it. So it's one of those games. I think it's a very interesting game, both conceptually and how it's done executionally. But I wish both the performance and the input responsiveness was like just better overall to make it feel better to play. Because there are definitely times in this game that like I kind of get a little bit ticked because like the performance of the game is not up to snuff with like the inputs that I'm giving it. I feel like I have to be very deliberate and careful with what I'm doing at any given time because I don't know if the game's performance will fuck me over. Like I've definitely like out of these 6 characters that I played, 3 of them I got to Grail Battle and got second place. 3 of them I couldn't get to there, but like one of those 3 that I got to get to the Grail Battle, I definitely fucked up because I was pressing a button and the game would not respond to it. In time, that sucks. But what are you gonna do? But I do like that. Like, hey, it's a really interesting game from Soft. It's unlike. I was afraid it's gonna feel like too much Elden Ring Night Raid. It's definitely not. It's definitely more tabletop inspired in some ways, and I've seen that from other outlets' like previews who are detailing the game in that regard. Like there's a lot going on. Like there's also like this whole other sigil system that like I haven't really had the time to get into. I don't know if I'll play more of the network test. We'll see if I have time to do so. But also I don't know if there's a game I'd pay $60 for if they're gonna sell this for a $60 game. Because I don't really know the meta progression. And 2, it's like I feel like it'll get old fast for me personally, like, in terms of like the PvPvE format. It's cool that like everything feels fresh and new, but like I don't know how I'm gonna feel about that like, you know, 20 to 30 hours in. I might be like, okay, I'm kind of checked. So I don't know if I'd pay full price for this, but I think it is an interesting game that definitely has flaws. And hopefully it does well, you know. Hopefully, I think the big fear for this game, and I understand like they've already detailed in interviews like why they went Switch 2 exclusive and how Nintendo was very cooperative with From Software in developing this game, but my fear is like, will it have a persistent player base, you know, let's say like 6 months after it comes out, a year after it comes out, you know, will there still be players that you can play with? And if not, then what does it do? If there's a very small player base, it's kind of the fear
that
of
makes me wonder. Like I was gonna look, I'm only using this because it's the only available one. Like Elden Ring, right? Night Rain looks like it still has ballpark like 20 or 30,000 daily players. So you've already detailed how those two games are different. And of course, Night Rain is not exclusive to one console. So I'm using it as a point of comparison, though I fully acknowledge that it is not apples to apples. So hopefully From Software has at least learned a bit to kind of know like what they need to do to maintain a player base like that. But I'm also interested to see like how it holds up.
Yeah, it's also different with this because like in Elden Ring Nightmare, it's up to 3 players and you can play, you know, solo and duo. In this one, you do need the full aim.
Good point.
Yeah, so you do like, I don't know how it will handle like if there's less than 8 that it can find, you know, what happens then? Yeah, a lot of questions in that regard. But this game is more demanding player-wise to even like do a full match on.
when you were describing two Zorks headbutting each other, mm-hmm. and like, is that really the best use of your time or whatever? There's a poorly drawn lines comic where it's like, I'm angry. Here's a solution. I don't want a solution. I want to be angry. It's like, I want to headbutt this guy. Are you sure that's what you want to do to win? Like, I don't want to win. I want to headbutt that guy.
That's right. Goddamn right. Oh, yeah. Zork is great, man. I'm very happy to have fast Zork has become a cultural icon at this moment in time.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, thank you for detailing your time with the network test, which as the time of recording is still ongoing, though, like you said, it's specified scheduled time slots. And it sounds like they're planning to add more, but those details are still pending. We have an article up that had the originally announced times. Hopefully we can keep that up to date if they do add more sessions. Before we get into news, we'll have a few more article shout-outs here. We already did talk about the Brigadine performance feature from Mikhail. We'll talk a little bit about Trails, because there's a handful of news and talking about Trails. We do have a performance piece on that as well. Let's see. Well, actually, Josh, while you're kind of have the microphone here, you did put up a feature about the recently announced Super Robot Wars Z2 remaster. I think we talked about this 2 or 3 weeks ago. So you wrote up a little bit about your kind of like your anticipation for the upcoming remaster. I don't know if you wanted to speak to it here or if you want to just, you know, point people to the feature that you wrote up.
Yeah, I like when it was first revealed, like I kind of let my mind settle down and like try to recollect my thoughts on it for a few days and weeks. But it was basically an op-ed in response to like, what the hell does this even look like? And I kind of detailed like why a Super Robot Wars remastered game is kind of a unique thing for the series. Like, even though this series has gone on for like over 30 years, and among its 50 plus unique games, there's not really many direct instances of like what you can consider a remaster. There's more remakes and direct ports than there is like a remaster. And what does a remaster even mean at this point in time? And I kind of make that point of like, whatever it's like, a remaster is just a marketing term at this point, because what remastered means from person to person versus what developers and publishers do with that term is sort of irrelevant in the grand scheme of things. Like, it's not worth getting hung up on like what does remastered versus remake mean right in that regard. So that's why like I point to like things that are like, the closest things to remasters are more remakes in Super Robot Wars, and I give like a few games and direct comparisons of like what a quote-unquote, you know, how these games were remakes compared to their original versions that I give instances of that. So it's kind of like a feature that I did probably more research than like I probably should have, but I was like, I might as well go all the way with it to make a point to people in that regard. And I bring up like other different aspects to it that like modern SRW games are lacking. Like, for example, is like in the HD era of SRW games, a lot of like background work, in my opinion, has kind of been sterilized in the sense that previous SRW games before the PS3 and Xbox 360 and all that stuff, were able to use direct like captures from like anime episodes as their backgrounds to show like, hey, this story intermission is focusing on this scenario from this anime, and you can actually make it feel more immersive because like you actually get the, you know, those direct assets from the show to facilitate these story interactions in it. So I was like, oh, it's cool. I recognize that scene or that background from that show. They had this, things happen at that background in that show, you know. But in the HD era, they don't really have that much in that regard. It still happens here and there, but it's not direct captures of that, like the episodes in the anime shows. They have to like redraw it to support modern displays and modern resolutions, which takes considerably more resources and energy and time to do. So they don't really happen as often as they did back then. And that is one of those things, like, it feels like we really lost something during that transition over, along with some, you know, other elements in that regard. But if you're kind of interested in like what this all means, I lay it out to the best of my ability. And it's also just me indulging my brain worms as well, in terms of like, I'm just very excited because the specific title that they're re-releasing is also one that's very special in terms of like it contains a lot of anime story arcs that are popular in the West that are not really explored in other SRW, like early season one Code Geass, early story arcs and seasons of Gurren Lagann, even Gundam Wing, like the TV version of Gundam Wing isn't really done in SRW anymore. It's usually Endless Waltz now. You'd have to go find the very old SRW games that, you know, went back to Gundam Wing's TV run. And that's what, like, this is the most recent home console SRW game that, like, revisits that version. It's not just Endless Waltz. It's not just, like, the Lelouch of the Resurrection movie. It's not just, you know, the final arcs of Gurren Lagann. This is why it's, like, one of those cool games that, like, for me, when it comes to, like, giant robot shows, I like seeing the progression of, like, the characters, like, you know, go through story arcs and get, like, cooler, more capable robots along the way. I don't like always being dropped into, an ongoing series where the character already has, like, the final form of their robot. I kind of want to see the stories of, like, what they went through to get there. Like, what character development did this character go through? And that's why I'm like, hey, this is pretty cool that they chose this specific title. I'm very, very, very excited to see what they do in this regard. So when a new trailer drops for Ruination Remastered, I'll be the first one there and be like, okay, what the fuck are they going to do? What are they doing?
Because remind me, we haven't seen anything other than the title card, right?
Yep, only the logo. That's it.
Yeah,
that's nothing else. So that leaves a lot of room for speculation at the moment, and people's imaginations are just going wild, understand. Yeah.
And hey, let's indulge in it while we can, you know.
Exactly.
A handful of other features up on the site, a couple of interviews. One from Mikhail and talking about the studio behind Lies of P. I believe this is from Mikhail. Let me double check. Yep. So Lies of P released on Switch 2, I believe, earlier in the month and has a physical release IM 8-bit? It has a physical release working on coming out in October, I believe. I forget who is publishing that, but it's available on Switch 2 right now digitally. So Mikhail spoke to the game director, Jiwon Choi, about Lies of P moving into Switch 2. Also about, I guess, the studio that made it under NeoWiz was Round 8, and they recently like rebranded as they work on a follow-up to that game. I actually do not know how this is pronounced. N-O-U-G-H. So now, no.
Does it rhyme with dough or does it rhyme with cough? I don't know.
So I should look that up. I feel bad that I don't know, but they've recently rebranded like within the month. Like that is their studio title going forward. They used to be called Round 8. They talked about their time working with Nintendo on Lies of P for the Switch 2. Talked about their studio rebrand. I know they've kind of had like a documentary go up on YouTube about their rebranding. About their, you know, what their game design philosophy, things like that. The feature on RPG Site talks specifically about the Switch 2 version of their game, what they have coming up in the future, and of course, as always, their favorite kind of coffee, Americano. Spoiler, I don't see that very often because it's like this is not charitable, but it's like a watered down espresso.
That's what I understand it as. Is an Americano is half espresso, half water.
Yeah, but so we have that article up on the site if you want to hear a little bit about the continuing works from the NeoWiz studio behind Lies of P. Adam, you put up an article that is basically with Team Ninja and the recently released Neo 3 DLC Hell Rising, which is I was hoping to have played a little bit before this podcast, but I hadn't. Any key takeaways about your time talking to Koei Tecmo and Team Ninja and the Hell Rising DLC or just Neo 3 in general?
I mean, they seem very happy with the reception so far, and they even mentioned that it hit the 10 million milestone for the, you know, I don't know how much of this is exaggerated just for, you know, embellishment, but they said they hit the 10 million milestone for the series earlier than they expected, so they had to, like, rush that announcement out. They weren't expecting to make it. Like, were you really not expecting that, or I don't know, but that's what they said. Either way, they're happy with the response so far. They talked about the new weapon in the DLC, which is new to the series. It's called a Hoko and Shield, which a Hoko is like a spear, like a short spear. And they talked about that this is kind of like a high risk, high reward kind of weapon and how it's used a lot in like festivals in Japan. like as it has some sort of like, it has that sort of significance to Japanese history. And then they talked about the how do you pronounce this, the Kayan era, which takes place 30 years after the main era in the game. And they talk about how this shows in terms of the story, in terms of how like the results of the story would affect, you know, 30 years in the future. So they kind of pick this era, which, like we said before, Kite recognized as the era shown in Fate Samurai Remnant. And then they talked, there was one question I asked about, like, how do they balance the game? Because, you know, balance patches are the most common type of patches you get for these sorts of games. And they talked a bit about how they very, very carefully try to balance the game, because they don't want to, like, ruin someone's, you know, efforts into making, like, their character. And they don't want to, you know, but they don't want something to be so broken that there's not a choice to be made. You just have to pick that one because it's the best one. And the way they put it was that the time that players invest into carefully selecting their gear to perfect their builds represents a tangible achievement, essentially an in-game asset. Since nerfing performance effectively diminishes the value of that asset, we approach any decision to do so with extreme caution. So it's kind of some interesting just copy about how they go about balancing a game like this.
Yeah, no, that's pretty cool. And it is something that you do wonder about, because you don't, you know, sometimes you'll say, what's the point of nerfs and buffs in a single player game? But also, I think you're exactly right, where it's like this weapon or this setup so overperforms that making any other choice is asinine. Like, you don't want to have it completely be unbalanced, that there's no choice to make at all. So cool to see kind of the, you know, lessons learned from developing multiple games of this style at this point in the Neo series and outside about their design approach to that sort of thing. We also have, lastly, an article with a interview with Michael Christopher Koji Fox, primarily known for his work on Final Fantasies 14 and 16, though did also work on Final Fantasy 11, and I think specifically was in a localization role for Shantotto. I actually haven't played much of Final Fantasy 11. I apologize, James, if you're listening. And just talking a little bit about how he started as a localization in the localization department over at Square Enix, going from Final Fantasy 11 to 14 to having a pretty prominent role on Final Fantasy 16, the Primals, all that sort of stuff. And then also his answer to Coffee, which I'll just leave as a surprise. If you want to know, you got to pull up the article. I think that covers all the features. Let me make sure. I tend to have a habit of accidentally skipping some. It looks like I didn't, so we'll go on. Into the news, not a big news week. I actually did not mark anything here as like a main headline, though this is going to show like how unplugged I've been for like the last 4 days or week or so. I have a dumb, earnest question. Was there a state of play in the last week?
Like, No.
Okay. When did they show off? I'll start off with this one. When did they show off Phantom Blade Zero at a state of play? Was that a few weeks ago?
Oh, wait.
I was not paying attention.
I guess there was a state of play in terms of like that there was one for Phantom Blade Zero specifically, but it wasn't like live stream. It was like just a video, I think. I thought you meant just like a general state of play games, but yeah, there's one focused on Phantom Blade Zero, but they just talked about like more into the game structure and how I think one of the cool things about it is like, all, like there's like 30 primary weapons and like 25 secondary weapons. And the more like you level up a weapon, like the more like capabilities it gets, not just like stat. It's not like just raise stats, like hey, you unlock new moves for it. And I guess there's like, I don't know if you use like an item, like some sort of like talisman. I don't know if it's consumable, but you can respec a weapon and just like, if you get like a new weapon, you can just like de-level a weapon, get its all the resources you put into it back, and then reinvest that into another weapon you want to try out and play with. And like this is the same thing with the skill tree. I'm wondering if it's like if it's free or not. I'm not exactly sure, but if it's free, that's like actually really cool, because like you get a lot of experimentation leeway then in that regard. So they didn't announce a demo. People were expecting to announce a demo, but they did not. And that aspect, and just like showed a lot more footage about it. Like, it was really cool to see.
Yeah, because I just saw on that thumbnail, they said state of play. What did they say?
like deep dive.
PS5 features and like state of play deep dive. I'm like, wait, there was a state of play. So
yeah, it was just for that game.
Under a rock for that one. Yeah, yeah. A couple other just there was also a trailer for the upcoming Star Wars Zero Company. They called it Final Trailer, of course, releasing in under a week. And then probably most surprisingly from the trailer aspects, we got a pretty long, lengthy video for the upcoming project from Game Science, Black Myth Zhongkui. So they showed off a pretty long gameplay kind of almost movie. It's shot in 21:9, which they made a pretty big deal about that. But I actually don't know, like, was that aspect ratio like a playable aspect ratio from the first game? I guess that's...
I think so. I think
it's ultra-wide. I'm trying to remember all the different aspect ratios.
Yes, ultra-wide is what I mean.
So they just showed off this trailer all in ultra-wide aspect ratio, which is pretty unusual, even if the game supports it. And I have not played Black Myth Wukong, so when I watched snippets of this trailer, and I didn't honestly know like what to pull out from it. But I do appreciate, as always, that they actually show some indication of what the UI looks like, rather than just making it like a like an AMV of new combat stuff. Like it actually looks like real gameplay, or at least something that's supposed to, you know, mimic real gameplay. So I appreciated that, and it does just look nice, just technically.
Yeah, that's very cinematic, very wuxia. A lot of like Chinese martial arts and sword play in it. I think the most surprising aspect to people is like during the boss fight, like you can summon a partner to help you, but like throughout that boss fight, you can like possess that summon and like play them for a little bit as well. So you have like this cool lightning swordsman summon that you possess and like continue to beat up on the boss with them. And then they also show like this new other female character at the end as well. I don't know like if there's some sort of like party gameplay going on throughout this game, but they show like a collage of like other footage at the end of this 15-minute gameplay video that shows all sorts of things to expect from this game. Like, I think my favorite part was like you're playing, I don't know the exact instrument that the character was playing with. It's like some sort of string instrument, and they're playing with a band, but the band is composed of skeletons playing other instruments. And I'm like, that's cool. Yeah, I want to play with a band of skeletons, and I hope that's like a mini game that you can. There's like mounts as well.
Yeah, at the very end, he's like riding like a warg or something like that.
It seems really cool. Like, from what I understand about the original myth, this is about like a human who became a deity. From that's what I gather. We'll see. What
I don't know, so means. We'll see.
Yeah.
And then I guess only the last bit of trailer news is last week we talked about the Kingdom Hearts trailer. I guess since we recorded last week, they did the extended trailer, which I watched. It's mostly the same information, though they did show like weird playable sections for like Donald and Goofy, which seemed kind of gimmicky, but they did show it up in the trailer.
Yeah, they showed that. And you're going to get to it. Yeah,
I was just going to say at the very end, Riku shows up like, oh, okay, Riku's here.
there's also like a playable Mickey for like almost like a paper book section like throughout the Mickey.
Oh yeah, part. That was weird. Like Mickey paper mache golem thing. Like I didn't know what I was watching there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's cool that the game seems like it exists and it looks playable.
Yes,
and that it wants to convince you that they are definitely going to make that 2027 release date time. I believe at the Disney panel that they had for this game that showed this extended trailer, that like it is 100% coming out in 2027. There's not about there's like ifs, nos, or if nos and buts. It's like it's 100% locked in for 2027. That's what the
I remember. I forget if I saw Gamatsu like retweet that or share that soundbite, but yeah, it was like, we're not shooting for 2027, we are releasing in 20, like, we this is a thing, like, okay, like they're very confident.
Yeah. Though it would be extremely funny and probably disappointing if they somehow still missed that target, then what would they say then? But
maybe that do you remember the Final Fantasy 15 when they delayed it?
Oh god, yeah, that's right. They had the whole fucking LA event that was like the release date event that they spent millions of dollars on, only to delay that release date they showed off there. That was remember.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was a crazy time. But hopefully, you know, we can trust them at their word on this, that, like, yes, next year is Kingdom Hearts.
In terms of like other game updates, we have a handful of updates talking about the Gung-Ho published, sorry, obviously Falcom developed Gung-Ho published in the West, Trails in the Sky, first and second chapter. That's probably a better way to leeway into that, but I don't know, one take here. So obviously Trails in the Sky, second chapter is coming out in the middle of September, September 17th. It has a playable demo. That's some of the new news. It's like the prologue and the first chapter of the game, second chapter. So it's a pretty extensive demo. Like they, I think on the tin, it says 10 hours or so of gameplay. And the first game had a pretty extensive demo as well.
That's a good chunk.
Yeah. Good, but then also them. this headline was the one I think.
Hold on. Before we go to that, Chow, did you watch the opening movie to Trails of the Sky, second chapter?
I did. All my friends hate this opening because it's like, it's spoiler galore. It is basically like those evil openings that you used to get in the Vita where it shows you all these like climax and all these like face offs. Like, it just spoils everything. It's just like, why would you watch this? And the song is nowhere good as the original either. So they absolutely just hate this opening.
I have to agree with them too. I love Trails of the Sky's second chapter's opening. It's like one of my favorites. And they fucking murdered it. I'm sorry, but they fucking murdered it. The instrumentation is like really bad for like, it's like, it's very, it's like a lot of noise, and like it's not even meaningful. It's just like a lot of very noisy and kind of bad. And as I said, there's the composition of the scenes. It's like, it looks nice. It looks really good, but it's also very, very spoiler filled. And like, you would not want the first time players to watch this because they show a lot in it that happens in this game. It's cool for returning fans, but for new players, what are you doing, man?
It's like watching those Final Fantasy like 7, like I forgot what those trailers are called, but you're like, oh, it's like, great, just spoiled every
The final trailers for Square Enix games. Yeah,
yeah, I never watched those trailers until I actually beat the game. It's like, oh, it's like, so
yeah, like, it's crazy. So sorry, Brian, I just had to ask for Charles.
no worries. The update that I thought was kind of the most surprising and interesting and made a few waves is that there was a version 1.07 patch to Trails in the Sky first chapter, of course, the one that released a little under a year ago, a legacy patch that was basically a glossary update for the game that redid UI elements, text, and voice acting to align much of the terminology that had changed for first chapter's release for the English version to align with what Exe and Nice America had kind of agreed on for the rest of the series. These are things like Jade Tower is now Esmellis Tower, Bitter Tomato is Acerbic Tomato, and all sorts of other things, even pronunciation, instead of liberal, it's back to liberal. And this was kind of one of those things that I saw a lot of positive reception for, as like, this was one of the big kind of notches against first chapter, that especially if you had played or entered the series in Cold Steel era or Daybreak era or whatever, or even just had played the game since Exceed's patches at the very beginning, that the terminology had changed with first chapter. And 1.07, I do not know how comprehensive it was. Like, people have probably completely gone through and compared side by side all of the voiceover changes, redone dialogue, redone menus, redone notebook entries, but primarily good on Gung-Ho to look at the existing series and line up the terminology again. I just thought that this was really kind of neat and something they didn't have to do, but they did. And it seems like pretty extensive too.
Very commendable. It's very commendable. I think everyone is universally just happy and glad that, like, hey, this is a statement from Gung-Ho about like commitment to quality for their partnership with Falcom in this regard, and not only to Falcom but to series fans, like, hey, it's more of like, we're sorry we let you down, we could have done better, and we're gonna make it up to you, right? So that's what this says. It's also cool.
It makes sense. It's like, they did it just because second chapter comes out, so it's like, it makes sense. It's like, if you keep going into the rabbit hole of having like those, you know, terminology changes, then it's gonna hurt you in the long run, so it's better that they correct it now, like, than later, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. They had to get like all the English voice actors back in the studio and re-record for sure. But also, like, people even noticed like direct side-by-side comparisons of like playing like the opening hours like during Estelle's childhood. Like, there's like entire lines changed that are like not even in response to terminology changes, but like just better flowing localization lines. They basically did like a, I guess, extensive editing pass and re-recorded dialogue for the change like lines on it. So like exchanges between like childhood Estelle and Joshua are beginning in the game, you know, just like completely like not new lines, but like reverted lines, just smoother flowing lines. Sometimes like the it just reads better, you know.
Yeah, they didn't just touch lines that had specific pronunciation or terms. Like, they recorded other lines that they just felt they didn't capture the, you know, the intent of the phrase, or the dialogue didn't flow the way they wanted. So it was, when I said it was thorough, that's kind of one of the things I was touching on, as I saw people comparing some of those early scenes with Cassius, or with, as you know, Estelle and Josh first setting out from their house early in the game, just some of the way the phrasing had been updated.
Yeah, and so. Also, everyone has to lay to rest the liberal newspaper now.
It's a liberal newspaper.
It's not liberal anymore. Fuck it over.
Yep. Let's see here. We also had kind of an update here, kind of a Square Enix style like press release newsletter for the December release, the upcoming Dragon Quest Monsters: The Withered World. Adam, you've become kind of an expert at putting together these like info dumps from, primarily I associate these with Square Enix because it feels kind of old school, and I feel like they do it with the most regular cadence. So Withered World was first announced relatively recently, like late in the spring, early in the summer. We thought, at least I originally thought, it was going to be a while away, but they said, nope, it's releasing in December. Can you kind of give us the lowdown on anything interesting that they showed off in the most recent kind of news dump for this game?
Basically, this is a smaller news dump, and it has to do with how Bianca and Nera go around to like revitalize the world they're in, which is kind of an amusing terminology, because it's like, we're going to revitalize the world of Witherwood, which used to be, let me get the correct phrasing here. Once upon a time, this land was lush and fertile. It's like, why did you call this kingdom of lush and fertile land Witherwood? I don't know, but it's basically how they go around the world. There's like this item or stuff called Meteosite, which I guess absorbs the despair of people and drains the lands of life's energy. So you destroy this stuff, you have a water wing can that you use to revitalize the world. So it's basically just a small little update. Some of the characters also that you meet about revitalizing the world of Witherwood. So less so on the monsters and stuff this time around.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, just some character art, character models, some screenshots of the game environments, things like that. It's fun even just to scroll through and just to see the screenshots and such. So that's up on the site if you're looking forward to Dragon Quest Monsters: The Withered World. That's hard for me to say quickly. I don't know if it's just my like pronunciation. The Withered World.
Doesn't roll off the tongue easily.
And then earlier in the summer, James did a kind of a little bit of a preview for the upcoming, also in early September, release Blood of Dawnwalker, really like, you know, 2 or so weeks away at this point. And Rebel Wolves, the team, has kind of put together 2 little updates this week, primarily showing off some console footage and like a little bit of a trailer for that, and talking a little bit about frame rate targets for that game. It will feature 30 and 40 FPS target modes on even like PS5 Pro. So I did not watch this console footage trailer, admittedly, but it sounds like even the pro versions of these consoles will have a 40 FPS mode and not a 60 FPS mode, if I'm reading this right. So if I'm wrong,
I'll... sounds like it.
Yeah. And then, of course, alongside that, they've also showed off that the PC system requirements, and that it's also going to be launching on GOG. The system requirements, like, I'm planning to pick this up on PC. The requirements to me seem pretty typical to me. Go ahead.
I remember they released the PC requirements a while ago, or I don't know if they like officially like announced them, but they had them listed. And I remember the old PC requirements had like basically top of the line CPU requirements, and those have been toned down. I mean, still pretty hefty, well, but not like.
Well, actually, I think I think I see now that I'm looking at this carefully. I think I see the crutch is they say final system requirements with DLSS or FSR enabled.
Oh,
and when you
yes.
say that, you're like, wait a minute, like to what extent? Ultra performance mode? Because that means then you get all like the artifacting and things like that. For instance, they say like for 1080p 60, they say a Ryzen 5700 or a, and then for yeah. a GPU, like a 2060 Super. And
obviously, it's almost a huge like difference like, well, if you're doing native 4K or DLSS 4K or whatever.
And then when they say like, and you know, this is where James could probably speak to it a little bit more detailed. Like when you say with DLSS, like, are we talking about just a, you know, DLSS performance balanced quality? Like those are all way different toggles. So which one did they intend here? So, all right, now that I see that, I'm like, I actually don't know how useful this table is at all. okay. Well, it's there. Hopefully it'll run. Okay. We'll see. I think that's most of the updates that I had. So a little bit of a smaller news week. A handful of dates here. Well, this first one's not really a date, just kind of a now available. Fantasy Life I, The Girls Who Steals Time, came out, you know, in the late spring last year. It is now available on mobile devices. It's basically, quote, like a premium release. So it's $25, no microtransactions, available on Google Play and iOS.
Cool. I mean, that it fully supports like cross save and cross play too. It's like that's awesome, man. Mm-hmm. You can fucking lose a lot of time to this game, and I wonder how well it controls on mobile, because it feels like you do a lot in the game. So I wonder how that handles it. But
I'm interested in trying it out.
It's very commendable that like in a perfect world, mobile gaming could have gone this route instead of where it went.
Code Vein 2 is getting a DLC. Is this the first DLC? Mask of Idris?
Yeah.
I forget if other. Okay. So that's releasing on September 9th. I'm kind of curious about this from like a Fringe perspective, because I remember Code Vein 1's DLC was not well received. I forget exactly why, but I remember those were panned like in the Steam reviews and things like that. So I'm curious how this one will land and like what they've added to the game.
Yeah, this one's interesting because it has a high barrier of entry too, because it requires you to almost like beat the entire game. Like you need to have like reached like the 2 out of 3 endings, I believe, to even access it.
So, oh, wow.
You need to have like almost pretty much beaten the entire game.
Little Witch in the Woods is coming to Nintendo Switch on September 16th, 17th. This is a PC, basically a Stardew Valley-like, but focused on... like being a witch and being, you know, magic focused. My girlfriend's actually played quite a lot of this, so
oh, cool.
She'll be excited to have a potential for a Switch version.
The release date is killer, but probably not the same target audience as the new heavy hitters on those dates. Mm-hmm.
But it feels like a perfect game. Like it'll find an audience on Switch.
Oh yeah, 10,000,000%.
Control Resonant, it's has gone gold. This is still releasing on September 24th. This is obviously from Remedy Entertainment, the, you know, where they're going kind of full RPG for the follow-up to Control. But the physical release of the game is not coming out till October 15th. So I don't know if this was a bit of a surprise, but like, you know, we'll take our physical releases, I guess, when we can get them. That's the world we live in now. But yeah,
weird. It's like a month, as of this recording.
And like, I feel like at this time last week, we knew the release date, and I presume, I'm not following this game super closely, that we would have just assumed that, you know, physical and digital same day. That's how games work, right? Or, you know, except for maybe some indie titles that get physical releases supported by like limited run or whatever later. But this game, they're like gone gold. But by the way, if you want a physical version of Control Resonant on PlayStation or Xbox, it's not until mid-October. So it's like, oh, okay. But yeah, there you go.
I need to find time to replay the first Control. Where will I find the time? I don't know.
Not between now and ever.
Don't say that.
I was gonna say, and what?
I need to believe in myself somehow.
And then finally, RPG adjacent, Cyberpunk Edge Runners 2 will begin airing on Netflix on October 20th. And alongside the announcement of that date, they've released a short little 1-minute trailer for kind of hyping up that date.
I've kind of kept myself off of like any promotional material for this game. Like I know the character designs, I can feel like I'm sharing them, but I haven't really seen like even the first trailer. I didn't Trivet.
Yeah, I didn't look at it either. Yeah, I'm pretty much in the dark of it. I watched the first season of Edgerunners, so I heard it's using a different cast. Well, consider what happened at the end.
It's like a separate story.
I think we've talked about it. It feels like this is more like a separate series than a second season, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So,
which is just, I think, the right decision.
And that's every headline that I had for this week. So, again, I'll shout out those many features that we had up on the site, starting with the Brigadine review, the Super Robot Wars Z2 kind of op-ed, the performance features pieces on Trails in the Sky First Chapter, Brigadine, and what was the other one? Maybe that was it. We also have the interviews with Team Ninja and Koji Fox. We do have one more podcast in August. I'm wondering what we can speak about next week. Let me look at Adam's RPG site calendar to see what we're looking at late August.
There's a bunch that comes out that first week of September. Not sure about, I think Zero Company we might be able to, maybe?
I'm interested in that thing that they announced at that Pixel game thing that's supposed to come up in 2 days. We hear the Terra Enigma theme. And then we hear...
Oh, yeah. There's been rumors about that.
And then the girl says, wake up, wake up. It sounds just like Ellie's first line in the game where it tells you to wake up. So it's like, could there be a Terra Enigma remaster? Remember, we always been using that as our podcast theme for many years.
Not anymore.
We used to.
Yeah, there you go.
So yeah, 2 days. I'm hyped for that announcement, whatever it could be. It better not be like that Final Fantasy VII announcement by Hashimoto. It's like, hey, you
want to that'd be so funny. That'd be
oh,
so
my
funny,
God.
Oh, that's almost ancient history at this point, but yeah, that was a great time. Check out RPG Site on all the social media networks. Just search for RPG Space Site. You should be able to find us. You should bookmark RPG Site. You should click the Discord link, join our Discord, discord.gg/RPG Site. You should thumbs up the YouTube video or the podcast wherever you're listening to this. You should leave comments on our posts. You should engage in the Discord. We like to always see the activity there. We'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to you all later.